You just have to keep going. You have to want it enough to wake up tomorrow and do the same thing over.
This was me being a hustler.
The only way that I've gotten to this point in my life is to try to treat people the way I want to be treated.
Welcome to Ground Zero Growth with your host, Sam Sapp, owner of Lockbaud.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Ground Zero Growth. I'm here today with my guest, Harry Campbell, who I met at a business networking event. Shout out to Kansas City B2B. I heard him speak. And Harry, I got to say, when I heard you speak, you were one of my favorite speakers with regards to directness. I still remember your intro, which went something along the lines of, this is one of the best presentations I'm going to do. I live right up the road. I'm doing it out of the goodness of my heart. So if you guys don't like it, I'll just leave.
That sounds like something I would have said. So I'm not remembering it, but I'm buying it. How about that?
Well, I mean, as soon as you said it, I was like, man, I am locked in. Let's go. Harry's my kind of speaker. And it's funny, I even kind of compared you to Gary Vaynerchuk in that I asked early on and you said you don't mind cussing. You kind of even ask in keynotes if it's something that you're allowed to do or not.
Absolutely. It's one of the most important questions I get when someone calls and asks to engage me in a keynote speech. I do 45-minute keynote speeches with about 15 minutes of Q&A, but very important to me is my ability to cuss. Now, I'm a social cusser, so I stay away from some of the more, some of the stronger language. But at the end of the day, it's part of what I do and how I do it, and it provides emphasis, and it keeps me rocking and rolling.
So let's kind of dive into, we're going to go off the rails a little bit here because my curiosity is just going to peek over everything. I can already tell. So let's dive into that. So when did you decide that social cussing was a part of who you are? Like, let's kind of go through that discovery of like, when did you just unlock and you're like, that's just me. I'm not going to bother with the folks that say, oh, you should be careful of this, that, and the other.
I think the answer to that is college. So I grew up with two teachers for parents, and I even had my mom for class in high school, Latin 1 and Latin 2. Having your kid in class is never particularly fun. My mom would say, no, not easy. But at that point, I started to realize that I tend to be very joyful, I'm mischievous, and I also try to impact people and inspire them and maybe surprise them some. And the use of social cuss words works with that. And a lot of times, people aren't expecting it, and so it makes them lean in and pay more attention and therefore maybe remember more and engage more with me, which I love.
Wow, that's interesting. So early on, you were kind of playing with words then as a means to engage an audience, really early.
Absolutely. I went to Vanderbilt, and I was an East Asian History Economics double major. No, I have no idea what I thought I was going to do with that. But when you have teachers for parents, what they do is they assume you're going to college to grow up, engage, learn to think, learn to survive and thrive. And it doesn't lead to a job, which it didn't, but it led to growth for me. And I loved that. I needed to go directly straight through to business school and get an MBA. I didn't need to. I couldn't find a job. Who was going to hire me? I'm an East Asian history major. And so what happened was I went straight through and at the age of 23, had an MBA in marketing from Indiana University. And I interviewed and got hired by Procter & Gamble in marketing, which was excellent for me.
Interesting. Okay, so Procter & Gamble was one of your first real careers then through even with the East Asian economics. So how was working for Procter & Gamble?
Extraordinary.
And how did you get that job? Did you just apply? Did they recruit you out of college? Or
So I did 4 years of undergrad and then 2 years of grad school. Undergrad and then Indiana. And P&G interviewed and hired from the Indiana Business School. And so I got on a schedule, had a really good interview, got invited to Cincinnati, had a couple of different interviews, and at the end of the day, came away with a job in marketing for Procter & Gamble. Marketing there is called brand management because it isn't just spending the marketing dollars. It's also understanding the brand and the strategy of the brand and the messaging of the brand. So they really treat it very broadly. And what they want to have for people that are brand managers, which was, I was in the brand management organization structure. I was just at the entry level. What they want is people who are thinkers and problem solvers and communicators and have grit. Said another way, they're looking for skill sets, not worrying about what you've done. And that worked to my advantage because having been an East Asian history economics double major, no one's looking at that and saying, oh, he's a perfect fit for my job. What they're doing is looking at the skill sets they see in me and saying, that's what we want. Harry, if we hire him, which they did, and I started on Crest toothpaste, he will figure out the category, the competitors, the strategy. He will work on weekends to make sure he's just as informed about the category as anybody that works in it. And at the same time, he will bring the skill set that we're looking for from him. So that really worked. I spent 7 years out of business school. My first 7 years of my career, 1985 to 1992, were with Procter & Gamble doing exactly that in brand management.
Interesting. We have a core value over here, gritty. It sounds like that's what you're describing. They hired gritty folks.
I love that term. It's overused, but that's okay. I still love it. The way I think about it is that's the way I lead my life. I wanted to be a professional athlete. It was clear when I was six that that wasn't going to happen. No way. I wasn't fast enough, quick enough, couldn't jump high enough, but I could understand how things should work. I could find the right people to make things work. And I had the opportunity to inspire and engage people. And I thought, you know what? That's a pretty good thing for someone who can't fulfill their dream of being a pro athlete.
Problem solver. Yeah. So tell me. Tell me a little bit about that then, because here's what I'm kind of struggling with here. So you're talking about brand management for Procter & Gamble with really not a lot of history. They're hiring gritty folks and expecting them to kind of figure it out. Can you walk me through figure it out? Because that, I mean, that's an ordeal for some folks that can take years, I would think, in the case of, obviously, they've got some sort of at least like mentorship or training in with it, I would assume, right?
Make no mistake, the answer to that is yes. Of course they do. But what they would like is they would like someone coming in with a relatively blank slate on how to operate the business so that P&G can teach you their ways and their understanding and their success factors. And then what happens is they have someone that is trained on how to manage a brand in a category who has their own special skill sets that could be different than the next person down the hallway. And I love that idea that they were allowing me to bring my skills and trusting me to understand the category and the company and the processes on how to work. With Teachers for Parents, I didn't have a lot of business experience. The people in my hometown were farmers and college professors' kids. And so I really didn't have a foundation in how to run a business or how to think about finance or marketing or product supply or engineering or anything inside a business. P&G knew that they could train me on that and help me with the platform so that I could be successful. But they wanted me to bring the skills that they saw, more importantly, while I learned everything else.
Wow. Yeah. So walk me through some of those early growth moments then, as you're kind of drinking from the fire hose.
Yeah. Obviously, with the name of the podcast, I did some note-taking on my thoughts on my different points of victory and humiliation. And I love this. The first thing that I felt very good about was long-distance running. I wanted to be an athlete. I wasn't good enough to do that, or any of the stick and ball sports that take skill sets. But I realized I run the same speed for 5 and 10,000 meters as I do for 100 meters. So I became a long distance runner, not because I like running. In fact, I don't, but because I wanted to compete and I love competing and I love being around athletic people, and cross country and track enabled me to do that. So in track, I ran long distances, and in cross country, same thing. It's just that track has all sorts of other events that you can participate in. And I love doing that because it enabled me to put forth something that I was pretty darn good at. I ended up setting the Vanderbilt school record for 10,000 meters in 1982, and it stood for 34 years. And it wasn't because I loved running. It's because I wanted to compete and I wanted to be an athlete, and I wasn't good enough to do any other sport but cross country and long distance within track. And it mattered to me that I was able to be successful. It was very cool to be able to get up in front of folks and say, I have the school record for at Vanderbilt University for 10,000 meters. That made me very happy. And that was my first dream and fulfillment of it. And in some ways, set the stage for all sorts of things that were going to come later, because making a commitment to yourself and a goal and achieving it is pretty damn cool.
Well, and I'm interested to hear, how was that pivot? Because, I mean, the way you described it in this just right now, and I'm listening, you know, you said, I wasn't good enough to do that. And I feel like, for what little bit I know you, Harry, my guess is you mean it's like, you know, hey, I tried it really hard and that wasn't the thing. But I recognized, like you said, I recognize I ran the same distance on short as I did on long. So obviously I'm going to do long distance. But for somebody listening, they might be thinking, oh, he gave up, which I didn't hear that. I didn't hear I gave up. I heard I noticed this, and so I pivoted. So I'm hearing an early pivot. Can you kind of help describe some of, did you feel like you were giving up? Did you, I mean, because there's other people out there that might be thinking, oh, well, he doesn't think he's good enough, but surely he was good enough because he did this. I'm trying to get it in the head of somebody that maybe needs to do a pivot and they don't want to give up.
Well, hell no, I didn't give up. Pivot, I never really thought of it as pivot because I think of that as a business term. But from a personal standpoint, that's what I did because I wanted to be involved in athletics. I knew and watched people that were good at baseball and golf and basketball and football. And I realized I should try, and did everything I could to try to make teams. And if I did make the basketball team, but I was the last man down on the bench, so I didn't play until there were 30 seconds to go. Realistically speaking, the world smacked me around in all of my efforts to do that kind of stuff athletically, except for the long distance running. And that's why I peeled off all the other ones and stopped worrying about it. If I was going to be involved in basketball, I would have been a coach, or I would have gone on to a different path in order to try to mentor players and coach and try to win. I didn't. I decided I wanted to participate, so therefore I got involved in long-distance running, and I got pretty damn good at it.
So your dream was to compete and succeed?
Yes.
Which you were competing in didn't matter as much. Did you know that when you started, or was that something that evolved and you realized when you found the thing?
Wow. I think the fair statement would be I realized when I found the thing, and it made me realize that I was proud to have found an athletic endeavor that I could compete in and do well and succeed, which I hadn't before, and it was obvious that it wasn't going to work. I didn't give up. I continued to try in all sorts of other sports that are more prestigious. The number of people that come watch a cross-country meet, single digits. And four of them are my grandparents and my mom and dad. I mean, this just doesn't happen. You're not doing it for any sort of glory. You're doing it because you personally want to succeed, and that's why I did it.
Well, it might seem like we're spending a lot of time on this one thing, but it interests me because I see a lot in what you're talking about, you know, in business and in life in general, where you know, maybe somebody has an idea, right? And just because that idea doesn't work should necessarily mean they should give up. And they learned plenty of things in the idea that maybe didn't work so well that might apply towards the idea that will work fantastic. And so it's interesting to see it even in early on in the sports thing where you're targeting your dream of, and your dream changed, right? I mean, it sounds like the first one was probably to be the best darn basketball player there was, but then it was like, well, you know, hard to do that in the last 30 seconds of every game. And then you end up in long distance track. And that's when you're cross country. And that's when you see the fruits of that. So, yeah. That's a lot. Yeah, that's great. Honestly, I got a little bit emotional there because it's I can tell, you know, you achieved the dream, that first one. And
it mattered to me then, and it matters to me today, because it was the first real thing that I said, what do I want to do? How do I want to do it? Why do I want to do it? Let's go do it. I did it. I set the record in 1982, and I will never forget that race. It was at the University of Tennessee's track. It was a night race in April of 1982. I was feeling good. I was in really good shape. The field was going to be good, which helps when everybody's running faster. And it worked. And I was overwhelmed with emotion when I got done, because I had expectations that I would do well, but it was an excellent race for me in a way that I couldn't have possibly dreamed, and it made my year.
Did you know immediately you had set the record, or was there somebody that came up afterwards that was like, hey, by the way?
I knew what the record time was. You're on a track, so it's 25 laps on a track. My goal was to break 30. The record was, I think, 31 and a half minutes. I ran 31:11 is what I did. I would have loved to have been under 31 minutes, but the bottom line was the school record was what I was shooting for. And it was clear when I was running that I had a chance to break it. I did negative splits, which means the second half of the race were faster than the first half. And that's when you come by the finish line time after time in this long race, they tell you your time. And I realized that I was strong, getting faster, and the laps were getting better. And I also had a very good time going. So at a certain point, I think my spirits were lifted by the fact that my splits were going so well. And with a mile to go, four more laps, I realized I'm going to break this record, and nobody's going to stop me.
So we're going to kind of fast forward just a little bit, because you ended up managing teams at Procter & Gamble, correct?
Yes.
I want to talk about how you brought some of that into your management style. Some of the people you managed. And I'm particularly, for some reason, I'm zeroing in on my head on, you probably got some people that you're managing that didn't win the race, that don't have that gritty sort of like, they haven't pursued a dream yet. And so how did you take what you learned at the race, fostering and pursuing and bringing about the dream into your management style, especially when it comes to that guy that's just like, have you zeroed in on the dream yet? Are you really ready to get this across the finish line? Because we're going.
Oh, that is what it is like to be a brand manager at Procter & Gamble. I think my last brand I worked on was Metamucil, so I was number one in the number two business, right? That's my obligatory statement I get to say as my joke. The brand group had me plus four other people, and so I was managing them. One of them was a mediocre employee, but this was early on in my management, and I didn't handle him particularly well. I was a people pleaser. That was the role that I played in my family, and I brought that to my first management experience. And having people pleasing traits can be bad if not handled, and I didn't understand it or handle it well. So the person that was working on my team that was at best mediocre found me as someone that would help him and do his work to make sure it got done well, because I wanted him to like me. Also, the work needed to be done. My boss was going to oversee it, so I needed to make sure it was quality work. The other three people were excellent as independent workers. If they needed my help, they asked. And we did fine. This one person exacerbated my problem of being a people pleaser by not being great at the job and having me needing to do a lot of their work. And I was fine doing it as a people pleaser I needed to. So that first experience that I had with a full brand group, working on a business with a mixture of quality of people working for me, was where all this came to head.
Well, and it's interesting because, you know, it's nifty hearing that aspect of things, because I remember seeing your presentation and something you said really stuck out at me, and I've been quoting it a few times ever since. And of course, now that I need it, I'm going to struggle to recall it perfectly. But if I recall, it was something like the 97% rule, which is 97% of the folks that you hire when given autonomy and the ability to do their job well with a degree of mentorship are going to do a pretty darn good job, I think, is, you know, something like that. And then, you know, it was like the other, you were zeroing in on the liars and cheats, the people that you should get rid of, which are really just the, you know, the 3% by the time it's all said and done. And you should be able to spot them and get rid of them quickly. Did I do that any justice, Harry?
Damn, Sam, that was pretty impressive. It's the Harry Campbell made-up rule. I call it 98-2. You said 97. You were close.
Okay.
What I realized after managing people over a few years and having some great experiences and some not so great is that if you treat people like adults, you give them the tools to do the job you're asking them to do, and you give them the help they need when they need it, 98% of them are going to do a solid to great job. They don't want to be seen as negative Nellies. They don't want to be the squeaky wheel. They don't want to be the people that fail. They want to do good work, or at least solid work. But if you put them in a position that they feel put upon or they don't feel helped, you also want to help them feel connected to something bigger than themselves. And if they're able to do that, what happens is a vast majority of people will be just fine. And in some ways, this is my optimism. I'm a very optimistic person. I'm very realistic when it comes to running a business, but I'm optimistic about people. And I didn't even believe the 98-2 was going to happen. But when I started treating people like adults and giving them the tools and make them feel connected to something bigger than themselves, the business results in my group just kept spiraling upward in a very good way. So I finally started learning that people that aren't good need to be coached up or coached out, not have me do their work for them. And I learned that. And all these things started coming together to make me even more productive. And I've realized the magic that I had in my specific skill set was culture building, people relationships, communication, a lot of what some people would call the soft side to business. But the sneaky fact is, if you do it right and you get the right people, you can win with that thing all day.
It's one of those things where I think it's easy, but it's hard. You know, we had a high level consultant on, and it, you know, one of the things that it seems like most consultants start with, because I asked, you know, it's like, what do you start with in a company, that a small business? And it's the why and the values, right? Why are you doing what you're doing? And to your point, I think it, because I've been thinking a little bit more on this for some reason. I think, well, it's because I'm going to do a presentation here in a couple months on growing a business. And I've been thinking more on that and what that's going to look like. And it's probably going to start with a lot of the why and the values. And then I was thinking back on, I thought that was just such fluff. When you come out of kind of corporate America, so to speak, I think your average person almost resents that speak. Which is really such a shame if you think about it, because a good culture with a good set of values and a why, that should be the coolest thing ever, right?
Absolutely. And if treated well and right, it makes all the difference in the world. If the people that surround you and your organization understand that you're telling the truth, that you're being real, that you have their back, that you're not going to micromanage them, that you're going to want them to succeed, help them succeed, and in fact, help them move through their dreams, then what you do is you have the ability to win by getting people in that mode. This culture thing that I landed on as my superpower is something that I'm surprised more people don't do, is to pay attention to the values and the dreams and the wants of your folks. Work with them, because then what they will do is they will perform for you, and then everybody wins. And I love that win-win.
So it's possible we're talking about two different things when I ask this next question, but I do want to, because I'm curious about how do we balance, because I think sometimes, like looking back on people that have led me versus kind of my leadership style, I think there seems to be a balance between, if for lack of any better term, and you correct me, but I'm going to say too much transparency, right, where you don't want to burden the people you're leading with unnecessary fear. And like, you know, you have a goal and it's like, do you really want to tell your entire team, by the way, if we don't achieve this goal, our entire department gets cut? That might be a hypothetical example. Or, the reverse of. So that might be an example of too much transparency. I don't know. And that's really the question. And the reverse of like not enough transparency, where it's all just kind of smoke and mirrors and people are having to. Is there a balance there? Or is it one of those things where it's like, no, it's pretty obvious, in my opinion, that you should go radically one way versus the other?
I say go radically toward transparency. As you were talking at first, I was thinking, okay, there might be some exceptions, and there probably is an exception or two, so I would never say it's 100%. But you better be in the 90s with regard to the balance between these two things. And the reason why I do that is because it's kind of the golden rule. It's what I would prefer from my boss. It's what I prefer from the folks who work with me and for me. If I'm being a schmuck or an ass, I'd like to know it because it's not the way I am. And I think I've proven that it's not the way I am. Therefore, it's being an outlier. Therefore, being called on it is very real. And I will say, being an information hoarder or somebody that doesn't share because you're fearful that you might lose your job or someone in your org will bypass you or whatever, all that stuff is destructive when it comes to long-term thinking and winning.
Well, and what's weird, too, is, I mean, that's definitely one angle, but I'm an optimist, too, if you can't tell, Harry. But I think another angle is I think sometimes leaders believe they need to protect those underneath them, like the department being cut. You know, I'm getting in the head of an optimistic leader that said, or kind of a stoic, or a, you know, I need to burden all this. I need to shoulder all this myself. I can't have them distracted, looking for other jobs or whatever, under the notion that the department is going to get cut, because the department's not going to get cut. We are going to achieve our goal at all costs, right? And then the staff working for them, all they see is, man, this guy's really stressed out over this goal. Like, I get it. It's huge. But it just seems, is the guy getting enough sleep? And so it's just interesting because it's like, but the real question is that self-destructive? And I think you and I hold the opinion that it is. It's better to say, hey, guys, here's the goal and we got to make it or break it.
I think it's way better. And if you've established that you're introspective, you're real, you're willing to be vulnerable, and you're very straightforward with regard to how you communicate, and particularly when things aren't good, it's just better. I don't think withholding something like that because you believe it's too transparent does any particular good. It's not better at all. I think it's worse. I would rather say I'm not happy about it, but this is the way it goes. If we don't do this, our group could be downsized. We might be eliminated. Here's what we need to do. Let's try to figure out how we can help each other and go do it and get after it.
So, jumping back to Procter & Gamble, it's my understanding that through that, you got to experience working with Sam Walton. Is that correct?
I was around Sam Walton, yes. I just don't want to pretend that I did much work with him. I was in his orbit because I was with a multifunctional team from Procter & Gamble that moved people to Northwest Arkansas and were assigned Walmart contacts and worked with them in order to improve the business between the two companies. So P&G didn't just sell stuff to Walmart and Walmart pays the invoices. And I moved down to Northwest Arkansas. I was down there for 2.5 years. I got a chance to be around Mr. Sam. I got to watch him operate, and he was amazing. He was the person that led me to even solidify more my idea that the people come first in an organization, not the customers, because he treated his organization extraordinarily well. He had very high expectations of himself and them.
Hmm.
He was wildly successful. He was the richest man in the world when I was down there in the 1989 and 90. And it was fun for me to see how he operated and to see how he treated people extraordinarily well, but expected great things from them. And they wanted to deliver for him, and they did as a result of that.
So you could have written the book, Good to Great. Is that what I'm hearing?
It's funny you mentioned that. When anybody asks me in a Q&A session, you know, books that you love, I honestly, the first answer I always give is this is old school, but I love Jim Collins. I love Good to Great. And if you read it, it is simplistic. It's not complicated. It's not overbearing. It is just plain beautiful. And if you don't allow good to be the enemy of great, you have a chance to win big time. And I say the way to do that is to get the team right. Jim Collins would say, get the right people on the bus, in the right seats. And when that happens, you got a great chance of winning.
So have you, all right, so this is my curiosity taking hold again. Are there any personality tests? What are your thoughts on personality tests? Did they have a lot of those at Procter & Gamble, or are there any that you're bought in on?
Yes, there is one, and that had to do with my time at DuraVision. But I'll go back to P&G. They had one called the Whole Brain Seminar. It was before Myers-Briggs even came out, I think. I'm not sure. I've done Myers-Briggs. I've done the DISC. I've done the StrengthFinders. I think every one of those can help you understand yourself a little bit better, and there's nothing wrong with that. The one that I love that I had never heard of was called the Kolbe Index, K-O-L-B-E. And when I got to DuraVision, they were using it, and it had to do with finding the right job for people. And the simplest thing I can tell you is we filled out forms to try to understand what profile we needed in a specific job. So the med techs at DuraVision that meet you, take you through all the tests, prepare you to see the surgeon. They don't do the surgical work. They do all of the meeting, greeting, machine work on the eyes, etc. We needed those people to be a very specific type of person that loved process and followed the rules and would make them crazy if you got outside the rules. They are not entrepreneur. They are not independent thinkers. They are process people. And when I got to DuraVision, they told me we cannot hire someone in that job unless they have this profile. I said, wait a minute. Whoa, tell me again. What? So one of the first hires that I had when I went through it, we were trying to find a med tech. And I loved one of the candidates, but she didn't test for the right traits. And I said, I don't care. She's a winner. Let's bring her in. We brought her in, and she was a winner, but not for that damn job. What happened was she was too entrepreneurial. It's called Green and Kolbe. Thinking about how to do things better, never wanting to do the exact same thing twice because she's learning and challenging herself. That is the wrong job for that. That is the wrong
personality type.
And I blew that, and I learned my lesson because within 90 or 120 days, she was out of that job. We could have easily moved her to another role that had her type of index indicated, but that's not the point. The point is I didn't believe in it enough. And once we got to it, it became very clear that that was the right thing to do, which was to hire people based on that kind of index. I was at DuraVision for a little over 5 years, and we never did that again. We found people that fit the index, and that enabled them to be set free to do the best work they can do.
So I want to, there's angles here that I think it'd be fun to talk about and kind of discuss. So the first interesting thing is that I took a class thing recently. Mark Cuban doesn't do his own hiring for that reason. He said, early on I realized I couldn't hire because I was a salesman, and he's like, I would sell myself on the candidate. And in the same sort of way, the indication that I heard, maybe incorrectly, was that you connected with this individual, probably for the similar reason that you probably wouldn't do well in the med tech role, I'm guessing.
Yes.
But so there's something to some of this. I think we can agree in general, and to get the right people on the bus. But what I've also heard, kind of another angle, is scenarios in where the personality test almost gets weaponized. They buy in to good to great, the right people on the bus, the wrong people off the bus, which is a fantastic notion. Get people working in what they love and want to do, right? And then so they hire a consultant, maybe perhaps, and the consultant brings in these personality tests, because I think that's a key part in finding the right people and the wrong people. But then in almost a universal standard, they decide, oh, well, everybody fits this personality, is in the wrong role over here. And then they do like a mass transition and a mass firing. And I've heard this from a couple angles where, you know, people worked at the company and they were like, oh, this personality test, if you don't test right for that, it doesn't matter how great you perform. They're coming for you. And I've heard it in another angle even where it was, you know, certain consultants, they're careful in how they present the personality test because they've seen mass transition as a result. And so I guess what I'm asking is, have you seen scenarios where the personality test has backfired and been incorrect, or is there a balance there?
I have not. And that's probably because I am very careful to make sure that I understand before using a tool what the objectives and outcomes and options are. I make sure I talk to folks. Now, I made the mistake when I had that Colby and I was going against the flow the first time, but I learned my lesson big time that time and didn't do it again. I really love these tools, and I think it's kind of like having a therapist. I love therapy. I love going. I need people to talk to and to talk through my issues, and everybody's got issues. If you pay attention to what those tools are telling you, you can always learn from them, always.
That's fascinating. And so Colby is one of your favorites, mm-hmm. and the Myers-Briggs, did I get that right? Those are the kind of the go-to?
ENFJ. I like it. There's a pretty good book that describes the 16 most common Myers-Briggs profiles, and I love paying attention to it because, you know, humans are amazing, especially their differences. And if you can start to understand why they're different, it's fascinating. Like if you're a high F versus a high T, the third one of the Myers-Briggs, that's a big difference. The high T's tend to be very data-driven, matter-of-fact, could be blunt, maybe not. It could be nice, it doesn't matter, but at the end of the day, they're very data-driven, whereas the high F's in there trying to figure out relationships and inspiring speeches and trying to figure out why certain people are reacting certain ways, and are there things I can do to help? And they really had to do with the people side of the business more so.
It's fascinating. I've been lately, so I'll need to retake my Myers-Briggs. I can't remember my category right now, but I've taken the last one I took was DISC, and I think DISC was kind of an eye-opener moment of like, I've taken my Enneagram, I've taken my Big Five. Are you familiar with that one at all by chance?
No.
That one's interesting. It's free. That one almost gives too much data. It's got five categories, and then in each category, there's like another eight categories, and it really zeroes in on, it's a scale. The cool thing about the Big Five is it's a scale. It doesn't there's not one particular box, like your orderliness, it scores you on your orderliness from like 0 to 100, for example. And then you've got all these different things. So I've taken my big five and then my culture index and then DISC. And then what was kind of interesting too is I actually ended up feeding them all into ChatGPT and I started asking it questions about myself. And what you'll find, and then I've had a friend too. I've given her my personalities, and what's really interesting is when you start to realize that the friction you might have with someone else is a result of the fact that you see the world completely differently, it makes it way easier to engage in conflict resolution. Because I can just go to that person and say, look, this is how I saw the world in that moment. And this was probably my guttural response as a result. How did you see the world in that moment? And if you have their personality test, it's so much easier, right? Because you can kind of just, I should have brought you more spreadsheets.
You nailed it. The first time I heard about Colby, when I was sitting there being a little skeptical, the person was telling us, what you need to do is think about a way to communicate with someone in a language that matches what they believe and how they operate and what they think. And if you do that, you got a lot better chance of finding common ground and talking to them about what you need from the opposite end, and then figuring out how to work together so that the complement of the skills can drive to victory instead of the conflict of the skills.
That's interesting. Yeah. Have you... Once you matured in kind of your management leadership style, was there anybody you felt, I mean, obviously from a personality perspective, there's going to be certain parties that are going to be more difficult to talk to communicate with. Did you find yourself capable of adapting to basically every style, or were there scenarios where I need backup? I need, you know, I'm to use a DISC example. When you described Myers-Briggs examples, you know, I'm talking to somebody that's more analytical. I'm more visionary, so I don't want to deal with the analytical. I'm going to need backup. I need somebody analytical to come with me into that meeting, so that way there's less conflict. Or did you find yourself, once you had the full picture, capable of adopting more of an analytical mind?
Reaction is that I didn't let this get in the way. What I did was I used these personality index or traits to help guide me to do what I needed to do with the folks I worked with. And therefore, I think the answer is no, it wasn't a problem. I also know that there's a reasonable chance that I'm kidding myself and I was missing it and I don't know it. I don't think so.
That's fair. So you weren't at Procter & Gamble forever. What was that transition like and why did it happen?
So I was hired in 1985 to work in brand management at P&G. I worked there for about 3 years, and then I was offered the opportunity to go and run one of the brands in Japan. And at the same time, I was offered the opportunity to go to Northwest Arkansas and be the founding member of a customer team with Walmart. And I decided, for a variety of more personal reasons, my wife had a job, and if we went to Japan, she was not going to be working. We didn't have kids yet. Northwest Arkansas has ESPN. Japan, I wasn't sure if they did, and I'm a sports freak. There's all sorts of reasons, but I decided to choose to go to the Walmart assignment, which ended up being extraordinarily positive. 2.5 years, came back to to headquarters at Procter & Gamble. And at that point, to say I hated it is too strong, but I had been in the corporate environment and I was okay with it for 3 years, but then I had been set loose, sent to Northwest Arkansas, designed my, worked on input of design about what my job description was, and got a chance to be around Sam Walton and the P&G leaders that were down there. Everything was different and new and exciting. And therefore, after 2.5 years, I was brought back to headquarters, and I was not happy. I was back at headquarters in Cincinnati, decided to leave. When you leave a place like P&G, you need to leave well. And so I set about doing a very thorough job search, narrowed it down to 2 jobs. One of them was with Bausch & Lomb in Rochester, New York, and one of them was with Sprint in Kansas City. When I went on a house hunting trip in April in Rochester, it was snowing, and I decided that was not good. I also decided that working in the world of tech was kind of cool and might be beneficial to me longer term. So coming to Sprint felt good about that. And I did. 1992, after 7 years of P&G, I left and came here. And that was in the summer of 92, and I've been in Kansas City since. So I'm coming up on 33 years, which I never thought I would be here that long. But I have done a whole myriad of different things while I've been here. I just haven't moved my family, which has been, which has worked out great from my standpoint.
Fantastic. How have you loved Kansas City in the time that you've been here? I mean, you've been here long enough at this point. You're a Kansas City local, but can you kind of help? What, yeah. Once you were here, what were some of the things you loved and hated?
Well, I love it because it's big enough that it's got professional sports teams. And in America, that's usually population-driven, and it is here. It's a freaky sports college town also, with KU, MU, and K-State all here, and various other schools. So I love the environment of sports, and it's what, it's one of the things that drives me. I live in Johnson County, and the school system is awesome. The infrastructure has been well thought out. Overland Park has been extraordinarily well run for decades. We've only had a couple mayors, maybe 3 mayors in 30 years or 40 years, and it has been well done. Rush hour exists, but it's a bit laughable if you're from a big city. It's usually about a 45-minute window, and it means you slow down from 60 to 30 or 20 instead of get stuck. And I do not like traffic, so that worked to my advantage. It turns out there were a lot of transplants in South Johnson County where I live, and that enabled us to meet people and get some great friends, which we've done over the years. So there's almost nothing negative about Kansas City from my standpoint.
Yeah, I lived in Houston for about 5 years in my younger years, fortunately not driving years, but enough to remember what 4 lanes at a standstill feels like for good hour, you know, before things are moving. And I might still be misrepresenting it, but looking back, I just remember enough. I mean, we avoided it like the plague, and there wasn't much reason for me to get stuck in it. But man, in times when we did, it just doesn't go anywhere. As then you get in this moment of like, is it ever going to go anywhere? Like, my goodness.
I'm the most impatient person you will have ever met. You probably wouldn't have realized that. There's no reason to show that, but wow. I think three people are aligned because I grew up in a town with one stoplight. Three people in line, no, I don't like it. What I'm doing is I grind my teeth. I'm not happy. I'm fussy when I'm waiting in line. Ugh. And you don't get a lot of that in Kansas City, which is nice. My 2 older kids both live in Chicago. One of them's in consulting, and one of them is in the education world. And when I go visit them, it just is. I love Chicago. I'm a Cubs fan and a Bears fan. My two older kids live there, but man, are there a lot of people in Chicago. And you have to pay too much attention on how I'm going to get from here to there. I don't ever have to worry about that in Kansas City.
Rare. That horn gets used a lot, too. It seems like it's its own language that me and my wife have visited a couple times now. We've kind of adopted it as our little getaway spot sometimes. We don't drive. We take a Lyft or an Uber each time. And I'm just like, oh, man, there's a whole lot of I'm going to blare the horn and get into the lane because that's the only way I'm going to get into this lane.
Yeah.
And I don't understand that language because it's weird to me. So the only thing that's stopping that other person from hitting you is deciding that they're gonna brake versus in Kansas City where normally, I mean, there will be a few people that pass you, but normally that fourth or fifth person is like, ah, come on, get in here, let's go. You're just coaxing them in. So to that end, so you've got a couple kids then and a wife. And
I've actually got a high schooler still. So two kids in Chicago and one of them is a junior in Blue Valley West High School.
So normally I ask, and are you married to the same woman kind of throughout this story?
No, I'm divorced and I was remarried in 2003.
Okay. So after your move to Kansas City?
Yes.
Gotcha. Okay. And then, so tell me about what working at Sprint.
I loved it. So this was, I did.
And you said this was 92. Do you know which employee number you are? I can't think of when Sprint was founded, but.
There were hundreds, if not thousands. It wasn't that early.
Okay.
It wouldn't have been a thing.
That's fair.
So I came to Sprint in 92 and I spent 5 years. And that was a very formative five because I became, when I came, they promoted me and I was the director of marketing. I really enjoyed Sprint because it was a whole new business and category. And I kind of get scared by that in a good way. And so I learn and I absorb and I pay attention. And that, so I have a unique non-technical perspective coming from Procter & Gamble and working on Crest toothpaste. Now I'm dealing with long distance telephones and local telephone and then eventually wireless.
And you said you were doing marketing?
Yes.
All right. I'm just trying to get the picture of, I'm, yeah, tell me how your marketing Sprint versus
toothpaste. It was back in the time when long distance was ramping up pre-wire.
Okay.
And so it was the 10 cents a minute or 7 cents a minute, Candace Bergen doing ads, trying to get people to change their long distance carrier at home because there weren't wireless phones. So it was a completely different world, but it was fun. And, I didn't have to worry about distribution channels through grocery stores and Walmart, et cetera. What we had to do, we did a lot more direct marketing and driving people to call to our call centers. It was a really cool 5 years. Probably the best thing that I can say about Sprint in those 5 years were if you did well, you treated people well and your business results were good, you could get promoted fast. P&G is more like a law firm. You're the class of 85, class of 88. When are you going to be a partner? Well, in 4 more years, you're going to be on the list and you're going to do this and you're going to do that. Sprint wasn't like that. It was very much based on merit. And I came in, I learned, I treated people well. I was able to build the business and things were going very well. I ended up being promoted to assistant vice president. Gosh, how old was I? I was in my early 30s, so I was a little bit surprising to people. But it worked, and I came in and I was digging it. And then I did something that surprised myself, Sam. I was offered the opportunity to quit P&G and go work with a friend, and he had a small business. He had a 20-person sports marketing firm.
And you mean quit Sprint, correct?
I quit Sprint.
All right, I'm just double-checking. You said I had an opportunity to quit P&G.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
No, no problem.
Thank you.
Yeah, yes.
So this friend of mine had this business, 20-person sports marketing firm in Corporate Woods. He gave me half of the company. I decided to quit Sprint. I was doing really well. I was an early assistant vice president. But this sounded cool because I love sports, and I thought it'll be cool to run a small business and be a small business owner. I am not somebody that would want to start a business. I don't want to eat ramen noodles and go to the third mortgage on the house. But he had already had a successful business. It was called MAI. That period of time, followed by what came afterwards, was the most impactful of my entire business career and life.
And he jumped you in at 50% then? Is that what I'm hearing?
He did.
Wow. All right.
We were wildly successful. We were making scads of money. I was working in sports, which I loved. I got to go to Super Bowls and NBA championships and U.S. Open tennis and Ryder Cup golf, and I loved all that. And I was working that pretty hard. And then when I left and got to MAI, I loved it even more. The one thing I didn't love is I didn't love running a smaller company that much. I really liked large groups, inspiring, motivating, moving them. It isn't bad or good. I just didn't like it as much. We were good, and we won the Mr. K Award in Kansas City, which is the Small Business of the Year Award, in 1998. And it was an incredibly prestigious win. And we're at Bartle Hall, and they're announcing the winner. They have the top 10 of the people that apply. You don't know if you've won. Then they announced that we had won. The company was called Marketing Associates International, MAI. We won, and it blew my mind. It was the proudest I've ever been from a bit in a business standpoint in my entire life. This small little company, named in the 31st largest market in the United States as the number one small business, I just freaked out. Wow. It was so cool. And I should have stayed there for a long time, but then I made a mistake that cost me and taught me and damn near brought me to my knees. I decided that I would sell my half of the company back to my partner. He gave me half. I'm selling him half back. And the reason I did that was because I decided I wanted to be in the dot-com roll-up world of 1999. There were people that they were buying URLs and money was being thrown around in Silicon Valley. And the VCs and the private equity firms were looking for adult supervision on these companies. Adult supervision to them included people that grew up at places like P&G, so therefore they understand processes in business. People that had worked in technology, I had been at Sprint, and people that have proven that they can run in big companies, which I did, and little companies, which is what MAI was. So my phone wouldn't stop ringing, and I got so full of myself, Sam, it was stupid. Phone call. What about this? I was flying to the West Coast and interviewing at on Sand Hill Road, which is where all the VCs are. I received two, maybe three verbal job offers. They all were never solidified in writing, because these companies were all buying other companies, and they would have to go into a freeze moment when they were trying to buy somebody they couldn't hire. I ended up not going out west, but selling my half of MAI, and going into the dot-com world in Kansas City, which is the best thing that ever happened to me. If I'd have moved to California, I don't know what would have happened. I can't even begin to tell you. That's what I expected to do, but I didn't. I ended up in the River Market in a dot-com roll-up called UClick, which what we did was we were distributors of branded content. If you ran a website and you wanted Doonesbury or Dear Abby or Garfield on your website, you had to buy it from me, and then I paid the creator. We were the, it's just like newspapers do the same thing. If a newspaper wants Doonesbury, they buy it from a distributor, and then the distributor pays Gary Trudeau his portion of it. Same thing. Didn't matter what the business was. That's what I did. And I was started as a VP of marketing, very quickly became the CEO. And I really felt like I was going to make $1 trillion, Sam. I didn't have to move my family, which is turns out to be really great news, because within 1 year, this business was no longer, because it was revenue-based and eyeball-based, and there weren't enough people on the web in 1999. If you weren't AOL, you didn't have enough users. And so then the humiliation of Harry Campbell happened. I was 39, divorced, 6-year-old, 4-year-old, and I was unemployed. We had to close the company down. Half the people went back to the mothership, which they had spun off from. Half of them lost their jobs, and I was unemployed. And I was scared to death. The idea that I was going to make $1 trillion because of my background being perfect for VCs and private equity firms was a distant memory. This period of time didn't last long. I think it was about 6 months, but I was scared spitless. I had financial obligations. I had personal obligations, and I put myself in this position because I didn't pay attention to the depth of decision-making I needed to make and what options I was facing, and it was just bad. Matter of fact, I'm not happy even thinking about it right now, so thanks for bringing it up. Or maybe I brought it up.
You're welcome. Well, to that end, for starters, I should ask, because my depth of questioning, I feel like we're going to go a little bit later than what I said. Is that, if that's not okay, that's fine, but just now would be a good moment to double check if you're all right with that.
I can. The one thing I'm going to need to do is have to get my cord to plug my computer in. I'm down to 12%, but
okay,
I can stay longer, yes.
Well, if you wanted to do that, we can hit a quick pause here, so to speak.
Let me do that. Let me run and get my cord.
All right. So we did a quick pause and play, and you got battery life. And now, if I'm being honest, I've complete. Oh, I remember what I wanted to ask here, and this is why I thought, because we're going back just a little bit. There was an interesting conversation in like a forum I was in the other day. And so your comment about, you know, my friend gave me 50% of his company and I'm selling it back to him. You sound pretty distraught about that. And it's interesting. There was basically a question in a forum, and the person was asking, you know, what should I do? And the mass majority of the comments were similar, like, hey, your friend gave it to you, you should give it back. And I was one of the few with a semi-contrarian view, and for the sake of potentially being demonized by viewers, I'll recount it here. I said, I held the opinion of, I was like, well, if it were me in your position, I might actually sell back as well, but not necessarily at full price. Like, I would find the going rate and I would sell back at a significantly discounted portion. And then some of the people, they went as far as to comment, and they were like, what the heck would you do that for? That seems a little bit. And I told them, I said, well, if I'm being transparent here, it really just has to do with the fact that, like, I perceive my time as valuable, and if I helped grow significantly enough, I would like to receive some small portional return for the value given. Now, I understand honor and loyalty, and I'm huge to that. And so for that reason, I mean, it would depend on the person, but I would sit down and talk with them and say, hey, look, you were more than fair to me with giving me 50%. I should probably give it back to you. But if I'm being honest, I've got this weird tick in my head. And so if you don't mind giving me something in return for my time and helping growing this, that would be the route I would go down. So anyway, all that to say, I'm guessing you feel disappointed in that decision. And it sounds like maybe your friendship potentially suffered. Is that fair to say? No,
I didn't communicate that well. It was relatively inconsequential, and I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean that non-confrontational. He had given me half. I was giving up pretty damn good compensation package, and I was being treated extraordinarily well by Sprint, so he felt like that was what was needed. It was a 20-person company that didn't—
That makes sense.
Was selling hours, so they weren't going to scale to huge.
Right.
So we're talking about in the low hundreds of thousands of dollars, not millions of dollars. He felt like he needed to offer me that in order to have me quit Sprint. He did, so I did. We stayed 2.5-3 years. We made a scad of money, and we were voted Business of the Year, the Mr. K Award. A lot of that was because of my connections and my training, and that's the reason why he wanted to be partners with me. And he didn't look at that as bad or good. It was just okay, and it really was non-confrontational. We paid a firm, a valuation firm. They gave us a high and a low number, and I think we chose in the middle, and we were done.
Okay, fair enough. So the big regret was really just that you went from that to a dot-com explosion in 99. Yeah.
And of course, I didn't know that I was going to an explosion.
No.
9 months, and all of a sudden, that happened.
Why couldn't you just go back?
I did, but I wasn't sure I was going to be able to because, frankly, the main reason is I had a pretty high job. I was an assistant vice president before I left. I had been gone 4 or 5 years, and I'd been the CEO of an internet startup and an award-winning small business, so I valued myself more highly, and those jobs are not easy to come by at Sprint. But one of the things that—
Well, I might go back to MAI. Or MIA.
Oh.
MAI.
MAI.
Your colleague.
I didn't.
Sorry, I don't know. Is that not something you considered? I didn't.
And I think I've never been asked that before. It's not like it's a controversial question. I think mainly was I felt like my differential advantage and superpower had to do with large companies.
Okay.
I realized I wasn't an entrepreneur, so I want the man to pay me. I want the man to pay me well. I want benefits, and then if I do anything small business-wise, I'd rather it be a side hustle and not my primary. But that just had to do with what my interests were and what I believe I could be more successful long-term. I ended up going back to Sprint, not back to MAI. Because
gotcha.
Of what I talked about here. And so what happened was two vice presidents at Sprint were let go, and they hired me in as a higher level vice president that had two complete jobs. That was good. I've told all my kids, I've heard this many, many times. One of the things that I insist you do if you're leaving somewhere is leave well. That means treat your old or current employer before you leave, treat them well, offer them more transition than they can possibly imagine, tell them you'll help, tell them you'll do anything, because if you were in that position, you would want that and need that. It goes back to the golden rule. I left Sprint really well before I went to the dot-com roll-up, and so it ended up that those relationships made it so that I didn't have to be out of a job longer than the 4 or 5 months I was. It still was perhaps the most miserable period of time in my life because I was scared and worried and full of responsibilities and had no income. But it was the most humiliating point of my career because I had to shut down a business that I was in charge of. It was scary because I had responsibilities and I was unemployed. But it turned out, in hindsight, it was the best thing that ever happened to me.
How long was the unemployment period again?
I think it was less than 6 months. Call it four or five.
Man, if that doesn't feel like forever, though, when you're snapping the middle of it.
Thank you for saying that. It sounds short when I say it, but it felt interminable when I was going through it.
When I tell people, I feel so seen when you said, I don't ever want to be an entrepreneur or a business owner. I'm not willing to do ramen noodle third mortgage on the house. If that doesn't pretty much nail. And, you know, I tell people, I'm like, look, you've got this grand idea on paper and you plot it out and you're going to leave your job and you tell your wife, or this is what I did, you know, honey, we're going to take a hit, you know, a few months, a year, you know, we'll bounce back. It's a curve, you know, it'll look like this, right? And you draw it all out and on paper. Yes, 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 yes. Excellent, excellent, excellent. And then live that. Living that in the emotional turmoil of the moment in that valley is like, ooh. And then I don't know about other people's inner thoughts, but mine at the time tell me, you're here forever. You'll never get out of this. It's like, whoa.
Oh, yeah. I'm now reflecting back on that period of time. And it's the lessons are there, and I'm proud of the way I ended up recovering. But that doesn't change the fact that that was one really crappy 6 months or 4 months or whatever it was. Oh, my gosh.
Well, I was on a bit of a high horse prior to mine. I don't know if that's part of why mine was as amazing as it was. I had had all these opinions about people and value and worth. And, you know, when I hit that low, it was a moment of, was kind of full of myself for a little bit more than I should have been.
I like that. Very real. Then, you know, the way I talk about it is it was basically my age 36 to 40, close enough, rounding errors. So I had this cool 7 years at P&G, which included Walmart. 5 years at Sprint, I was rocket shipping up. I was an early vice president. So I was 12 years in, 13 years in. I got MAI for a couple of years. I didn't think I could do any wrong. So that's part of what led me to believe that getting into the dot-com world was not a risk. It was a logical next step for me to generate crazy wealth and be wildly successful. Ow.
So funny to me. I just love how relatable different industries, and just I think there's universal standards in stock market trading, of which I am not much but dabbled in. They say one of the worst things that can happen to you is you experience a win early. So you get into stock trading, the dot-com era, this happened for a lot of folks, right? They say you could put money on any dot-com stock and it would rocket. And so there were a lot of folks that got destroyed because they'd never been in the stock market before. They're getting all this money, and then they experience their first real hit. And then what's worse is normally after that is maybe normality, but you're thinking, oh, I'm a loser out of a loser after a loser after a loser. I don't know what I'm doing. I've lost my magic touch and I'm gone. Versus experiencing losses earlier and learning to overcome those into your wins.
Yes. Well, the what it led to was humbling, and that's a good thing. And it wasn't like I really needed to get smacked around, but it never does hurt to get smacked around occasionally, because you have to realize that that's life. I then experienced luck. And another thing I tell my kids, I tell them to leave well. Another thing I tell them is you have to get lucky at least once, if not twice in your life. And you're going to come to a Y and you're going to take the right instead of the left, or there's going to be a pothole on the left, so you choose the right. You got to get lucky. And what happened was I went back to Sprint. I was a full vice president. My boss was an excellent leader, and he was needed elsewhere in the company. So they pulled him out and put him over here, and they needed an interim president. They proceeded to tell me I was about 5 to 6 years junior for the job. I think I was 40. You're not going to become the president of this large division because you're early in your career, but we need an interim. And while you get this job as the interim, we're going to be looking around the entire country and finding somebody to come in to do this job. I said, cool. Then what I like to say is I get kind of insidious. What happens is things start working out, and I use this spiral upward here. The people results started getting better and better and better, and the business results got better and better and better. And after something like 6 or 7 months, and they had done some interview, and they finally just threw up their hands and said, okay, we're gonna promote you. That was sheer luck. That was in the right place at the right time. Now, I'm the one that helped drive the business results and the people results, but that doesn't change the fact that I wouldn't have had that opportunity if the job hadn't become open. And I recognize that. Some people think, you know, what is that, born on third, and think they hit a triple. I knew that I was in the right place at the right time, but it worked. And that changed my life, because the amount of compensation involved with that, long-term and options and stuff, were crazy. And that put the dot-com experience behind me. It still sat with me, because being that big of a failure was the first time that had ever happened to me. And so I didn't get over it quickly, and I'm still not over it all the way today, but it enabled me to move past it, even though I couldn't get over it. Does that make sense?
I wonder if you would have accepted that position if you hadn't had the gut check. Because, and you might be completely different, but I'm putting my arrogant Samuel in that role. And if you tell me, hey, we're going to promote you while we're looking for somebody else to replace you, even if I accept it reluctantly, there's a high likelihood I'm looking for the door by that statement. And this is pre-gut check Sam.
I think that's very fair.
So, we kind of need to skip along, because you don't stay at Sprint forever, do you?
I was at Sprint 5 years, then I left for 4, came back for 5, and then, so I was the president of the consumer division, then I was the president of the small and medium business, and when that happened, Sprint bought Nextel. And the strategic imperative was to spin off the local telephone division. So Sprint was a $24 billion company. They took the $6 billion that was the local telephone and they spun it off. So we had two companies being made. It was thought by most people, including me, that I would stay at Sprint and the Nextel people would merge in and I'd be in the wireless world, because that's where the coolness is and the sectionists and the fun. I chose, actually, at primarily my wife's nudging, to spin with Embark. So I went with the boring local telephone company instead of staying with the exciting merged new wireless entity. I still have scads of emails from that period of time that said I was freaking crazy. I felt like it was a smart move, because I liked Dan Hesse was the boss, and he was going to end up being my boss. I could pick my own team, because we're spun out, but we don't have the leadership team, so I get to choose my own leadership team. The commute was short, not to be underestimated. I live on Nall, and Embark was on Nall south of 435, so that wasn't an issue. And it was a new adventure for me that I felt like would help me grow.
So the only reason I know what Embark is, not to date myself here, but the only reason I know what Embark is because there are still, I think it's CenturyLink customers out there that have Embark Mail email addresses.
Yes.
Sorry, exactly, keep going.
Right. Yes. So I went with the spinoff, and it was a great 4 or 5 years. It was phenomenal. When Dan Hesse, who was the Embark CEO, was actually hired by Sprint to be the Sprint CEO, Embark's board of directors decided to sell the company, and they did. And that culminated in a 2009 end of game for Harry with regard to Sprint and Embark. And at that point, which is a long time ago now, wow. You know, it was that 15, 16 years ago. It was the summer of 09. I carried my boxes out. I was 48. Didn't know what I was going to do. Knew I wouldn't leave the city because my older kids were here. We had a one-year-old. My wife said, you got to figure out how you're going to spend your time, whether it's get a new job or do not-for-profit work or something like that. And that was an interesting time because I took a year off, decided to go back to work. Tim Barton's a friend of mine. He owned Freightquote, so I went to work at Freightquote as a senior exec. Realized I didn't want to work, so stopped that and then took another 3 years off. And all I did in the second 3 year, in the 3 year period as my second hiatus from work, I did breakfast and lunch for a living. And I got to know anybody and everybody in town that I could. I didn't want anything from them. I didn't want a job. I didn't want investment. I just wanted to understand them and understand the city and how people were connected. And I had the best, coolest 3 years. Then, this is beautiful. In the same week, I drove my oldest son to college and I walked my youngest son to kindergarten. How about that? And I came home and my wife said, you really need to get a sense of purpose because we've got a long way to go. We got a kindergartner here. Let's see what's up. And I said, I agree. And within 2 months, I got a phone call from Dury and I ended up becoming the CEO of the Dury Vision. And that was really a perfect scenario from my standpoint at that point in my career.
That's fascinating. And so...
And by the way, it was a family-owned and run business by Dr. Dury, and he wanted to transition to his son-in-law to run the business so he could go and enjoy the successes he had delivered. He didn't feel like his son-in-law was ready to run the business from a business standpoint. He was a great surgeon, but not a CEO. So he hired a bridge CEO, and our goal was 5 years, I was going to run the business, help them make money, set processes up, work with the next generation so that he could run the business better and well, and then exit out. So bridge from first generation to second generation with a five-year gap, and I was going to fill the gap. And that was a cool job for me.
That's a fascinating notion too, and that's a lot of perspective, because I've been in clinics where they have where the doctors own it, but they have an administration, and it's a fascinating and a lovely thing as far as I'm concerned, where it's like they have an administrator that heads up the whole. Basically a president. And even though they're the owners, they fall underneath because they want to continue to kind of focus in on their craft. and they recognize that it's like, you know, in order to actually run a lot of the bigger picture and day to day, better to hire somebody to do that, and then we can focus in on our patients.
That was me. A lot of law firms either should or do that same thing.
Yeah. Wow, to that end, okay, so, and maybe vision was different, but I've found healthcare to be an absolutely fascinating thing in that the producers or physicians, if you will, are typically overworked. And it's a high stress.
Anything you know about healthcare needs to be left at the door when it comes to Dairy Vision, and I'll tell you why.
Okay.
It's a premium cash-only business that does not work on the health of the eye or fixing your eye. It enables you to see better. So it is a LASIK and lens replacement, mainly LASIK, but also lens replacement if you have a cataract. But if you have a detached retina or macular degeneration, they send you somewhere else. This is a boutique, ultra high-end business that has a very cool brand. It is extremely high-end. It is anywhere from 30 to 60% higher price to get your eyes done with regard to LASIK at Dairy Vision than a lot of other places in the city, but it's your eyes, and the experience is extraordinary. You show up, the med tech that meets you is going to be wearing, they all wear really cool black scrubs. They have gold name tags. You never wait. You show up, the person, the med tech is waiting on you when you show up. It is really a cool business, and I had fun thinking about it and dealing with it, but not the healthcare side of it, because we didn't take insurance. If you want a high end but an extraordinary patient experience with great doctors and great machines, this is the place. It was fun.
That's exciting. Excellent. So what are you up to now, Harry?
So I did my 5 years. Then I transitioned to the next generation at Dairy Vision and left. 12/31 of 18 was when I was done. So now I've been gone 6 years. I do three specific things to keep myself busy besides walk the dogs and make sure that I get my exercise in. I do three things. I mentor and coach people. I have an interesting business model on that. I charge zero. And the reason I do that is because I'm willing to meet with anybody at any time for coffee and lunch. And I will talk about my opinions and I will answer questions and I will help if you have a business issue. But when we leave that meeting, I am not taking your to-dos. I'm not billing you. I'm not marketing for customers. So basically, it's a Harry Campbell designed, cool mentoring and coaching business that enables me to have the flexibility. So it's I can make the rules when I don't charge. The second thing we do is my wife and I invest in small business. We started one, and it's going very well. We invest in quite a few of them, friends and family rounds. We really like being around entrepreneurs. I love to coach them, mentor them. I am not one. I've told you this, and I've learned this about myself, but I love being around them because they give me energy for who they are and how they are. So that's the second thing we do is we invest. And the third thing is I have a speaking business. I've written 3 books. I do a keynote speech on each of them. It's called the Get Real Series, Get Real Leadership, Get Real Culture, and Get Real Mindset. And I give 100% of my speaking fees that I earn to a charity for brain cancer research in honor of my wife, and 100% of the book proceeds. I'm now moving towards $700,000, just short of that now, that I've raised with that business, and I'm not stopping.
That's exciting. That's exciting. What's the name of that organization, too, for the audience?
the money that I give goes, you're talking about the charity?
Yeah.
Head for the Cure. It's head as in brain cancer, Head for the Cure. Headforthecure.org is the website. It's a Kansas City-based not-for-profit that's over at 16th and Oak. I'm on the board of the organization, and I love raising money and trying to help them. I give 100% of my speaking fees, and therefore, what I really ask the people that hire me to do is to, if they're going to pay me $5,000 or $10,000 for a keynote speech, I ask them to give the money directly to Head for the Cure. Then I don't have to worry about being a 1099 employee and donating the money.
Fantastic. Well, this has been an absolute pleasure. As we start to kind of wrap up here, there are two questions, Harry, towards the end that I like to ask. So we have a motto around here, and the motto goes, if we have seen further, it is by standing on the shoulders of giants. It's a derivative of Isaac Newton, who said, if I have seen further, it's by standing on the shoulders of giants. Who's been a giant in your life that you would like to pay homage to in this moment?
I'm going
to
give you two. One business and one personal. From a business standpoint, the person is Tom Wigman, W-E-I-G-M-A-N. He was a senior vice president at Sprint when I first joined. He wasn't my boss, but he was my boss's boss. He was and is crazy smart, but also a people person in a way that mattered to me and showed me the way on how I could operate with people, hold people accountable, deliver results, and still enjoy myself and balance home and work. Tom Wigman. And then the personal one is actually my wife. We were married in March of 2003. She got diagnosed in February of 2004. We hadn't even been married a year. She has a malignant, inoperable brain tumor. It had relatively little effect on her life for the first 16 or 17 years. And in the last few years, she's been getting some tremors from the radiation that she had, not from the tumor, but the radiation scars the brain. And she has balance issues, and she has a tough go at this point. And I do everything I can to help her with my words. The reason I started my speaking business is because I wanted to physically show how much I love her. And doing the speaking business and being able to give the money to clinical trials that are trying to find a cure was the way I do that. So that's very cool from my standpoint that I can do that. And I love doing it for her.
Thank you. The second question is, what's kind of a guiding principle that you've found to be true again and again and again?
I bet on people. I bet that people want to do well. And if I create the right environment, they will, and we will win. And we will have fun doing it. And so I'm optimistic, I'm joyful, and I'm a competitor. And I love the idea of being able to put all those together and have a mix that is a culture and a business, no matter what the business is, no matter what category it's in. But we have a business that we win with, that it's fun to work in.
What are some ways that people can connect with you now? Do you have a website or something you'd like to plug in this last bit?
HarrySCampbell.com is my website. You can see the business, speaking business, some of the customers I've worked with, some of the tapes from some of my speeches. HarrySCampbell.com. You can go to Amazon. My three books in the Get Real series, Get Real Leadership, Get Real Culture, and Get Real Mindset are all on Amazon and Kindle. They're $10. The books are double spaced, 100 pages. So you expect to be able to read it in about 75 minutes. They're very me. They have my voice, and you'll recognize that. My mischievousness, but also the lessons that I've learned are captured in those books in ways that make me very happy.
Thank you so much for joining me today, Harry. This has been a pleasure.
I have had a blast. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Bye, everybody.
Hello, everybody. I wanted to thank you for listening to today's episode. It's such a blessing to be able to interview some such fantastic individuals. If you're interested in listening to more, we look to post every Thursday at 10 a.m. You can find us on YouTube, Amazon Music, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. Thanks so much. Have a blessed day.